Hey everyone, my name is Andrew Warner. I'm the founder of Mixergy, where I interview entrepreneurs about how they built their businesses. We get the stories behind the companies. We get to figure out what they did that worked that allowed them to grow often really, really, really big. And as a user, do you ever try a new app and come across a small problem? What do you do at that point? Usually what you do is you just give up on the app, right? And you move on to their competitors, and their competitors get to benefit. Well, today's guest founded a company that helps app makers and other software creators identify those problems before they hit your hands so that they can do well and beat their competitors. His name is Doron Rouveni. His company is called, and I freaking love this name, it's called Applause. Applause.com is the domain name. Impressive that they have it. They offer software testing, usability, and market research. And they do it in an interesting way, which we will talk about here in the interview. This interview is sponsored by two great companies. The first will help you hire your next great developer. It's called TopTal. And the second will help you do marketing automation right. It's called ActiveCampaign. I'll tell you more about them later. First, Doron, welcome in.
Thank you. Great being here.
I love it. How much revenue are you guys doing right now?
So we're just hitting the $100 million run rate from a revenue perspective.
$100 million.
Yes.
With a business that started out with so little money that you guys were basically scraping cash to try to figure it out, working with, you couldn't even pay your developers in the beginning from what I understood.
That's correct. So when we started the company, that was back in 2007, me and a co-founder, we actually had a pretty hard time, you know, getting funding. I think part of it is also related to the fact when you're a first-time kind of founder CEO, it's much easier to get, you know, when you've done it before. So, you know, we couldn't get any funding. And I think there was one of the things that we did is we actually really believed in the vision of ensuring quality in the wild across all devices and configurations. So we actually gave a small percentage of a company to a small dev shop in Argentina, which was, you know, kind of interesting. And they developed the product until the first beta launch. So, you know, I was going back and forth between Boston and Buenos Aires at the time. So fun
days.
Which
is not a bad way to live. But you said you had this need for quality. What was it? I forget the phrase. But the thing that strikes me is, nobody wakes up in the morning going, I can't wait to do user testing. I can't wait to start a user testing business. Where did you get the idea to do this?
So, you know, I'll be honest with you. The idea wasn't mine. It was actually my co-founder, Roy, who came back from a product and quality type of background. My background is actually engineering. And, you know, the pain that he saw in the market was at the time was no matter how much I invest in quality and testing, when software gets in the hands of real people, there's still multiple issues that get found. And his concept was relatively simple. What if we build a global community of experts and test engineers and research engineers and actually test on real devices and real configurations? So, you know, it was his idea. I was a business partner, you know, and I would say that was, you know, in 2008, that was kind of when iPhone first launched and apps went in the market. IoT didn't exist. Communities were kind of early stage, you know, LinkedIn was really. So it was a pretty innovative idea. I mean, now everybody understands the gig economy and, you know, communities and digital workforce and all that kind of stuff.
And I can see why he would be thinking about this. I'm looking at his background on LinkedIn. He did QA. He was a QA manager at IncrediMail. He was developer and QA manager at Blue Security. I don't know those companies super well, but I do see that QA, quality assurance, that's his focus. And that's what made him think, hey, you know what? There needs to be a better way to do quality assurance. There needs to be a better way to test. Right?
Right. Especially at scale. And, you know, I think many things happened in the market since then. You know, today the market is much more focused around digital experience and app experience. I mean, I'll give you an example. You know, I've had multiple customers that started with us because they had a pain point or an event, meaning they launched at a country and they wanted to cover, you know, specific demographics and specific testing. You know, they had, you know, their rating for their apps drop and they had to figure out, hey, what's going on? And, you know, this is the way we help them. So many times the customers are driven by an event or a need, but then, you know, once they start working with us, they love the speed and the scale and how much the velocity they can drive into the development process that they become customers for life.
Wait, so is there an issue sometimes where a company launches their product in the US and everything goes well, then they launch the exact same app overseas and then they have an issue and that's when they come to you and they say, hey, can you help us figure out what's going on overseas?
Absolutely.
What would cause a problem? What would cause the inconsistency in the app performance between two countries?
Yeah, it's not just performance. Look at even at retail applications, for example. So, you know, when Puma, for example, launched in 16 countries worldwide, we helped them test all their various stores in different countries. And, you know, you run into issues like payment validation, different types of credit cards with PIN, without PIN, you know, zip codes that are being used, not being used, you know, simple stuff like that. And sometimes it's even the context of how the app or the website is performing, meaning it doesn't resonate within the current market environment. And, you know, what we bring to the table is actually the capability to test with real professionals, which are feet on the ground in specific countries, which provide something, you know, that no one else can do if you have something which is really at global and at scale, right?
I see. And before that, tell me if I'm wrong, but it seems like the way that companies would test was they would have multiple computers and they would test on all those computers and see, does it work on a Mac? Does it work on a PC? Does it work in Safari and Internet Explorer, et cetera? And then if they tested in their office, they felt like it was good. Is that largely the way things were done?
Yeah, that's how things were done, meaning testing in a lab.
And you said, I want to get people all over the world testing in the real environment. So if you're going to launch in Canada, I want to find testers in Canada who are going to do the test.
Correct. And think about it. Today, when you talk about device and form factors, you know, how many versions of Android do you have? And they're different in every country. And, you know, you're talking about, talk about media, you know, streaming media. I mean, we test for Fox worldwide, all the way from Fox Sports for all of their media assets. Think about interactive TVs and gaming consoles and streaming capabilities, the complexity of what you're trying to achieve now as a media brand, as a retail brand, as a financial brand. You know, it's much more complex than it ever was in the past.
I see. Even with this big vision and this big need, you weren't able to raise money because you were a first-time entrepreneur. Your background was you worked for a company called Enigma. They're a data management company, right?
Correct. So I was actually in engineering. I was VP in engineering. And, you know, at some point in time, I think I figured out that I'm not a great engineer. Okay. You know, I figured that out when, you know, other engineers were complaining that they need to maintain my code. And I said, you know, I got to switch to the more the business background. So I did that in Enigma. But then, you know, I met Roy, my co-founder, and, you know, I believed in the idea. And, you know, we spent some time, you know, building it out. And, you know, I think at a certain point in time, it started taking off.
Our producer asked you what you learned when you worked at Enigma, and you said, one of the biggest lessons was to not rely on a single vertical. How did you get that lesson? Tell me about what happened there.
Yeah, so Enigma was an interesting story. I mean, they were finally got acquired by PTC, but Enigma was focused primarily on the aerospace industry and the airline industry. So, you know, mainly the customers were airlines and big manufacturers of OEM equipment, you know, GM.
What kind of data?
Well, it was basically managing parts catalog for those, you know, big airlines and big jet engine manufacturers. And then what happened in 2011 is 9/11 happened. And, you know, this industry stopped buying anything. I mean, they basically came to a standstill. And, you know, this is where I came to the realization, I guess, lesson learned is that, you know, I want to build something which is applicable to multiple verticals, meaning more resilient. It's also much more international in aspect. And, you know, obviously a community that has 200,000 people in 200 countries, that's very international, right?
And but that's your community of testers right now.
Correct. But also if you look at Applause as a company, I mean, we sell to software industries. We sell to media companies. We work with 8 out of the 10 biggest retailers in the world. We work with financial institutions. We work with automotive companies on smart cars initiatives. And we work with, you know, companies all the way from startup to significantly large enterprises. So the company is so solid from that perspective that even if an industry has a hard time, you know, we stand that. So we're good.
Yeah, that's a really important lesson. I remember actually in my first company being really dependent on email marketers. And as soon as the dot-com bubble burst and email marketers especially suffered, suddenly 90% of my revenue dried up and I had to rebuild my business from scratch, which is really painful when you when you're not starting with zero expenses. You're starting with all the expenses that you had when business was big. So
yeah, it's a challenge building a company that is applicable to multiple industries and multiple verticals because, you know, I'll give you an example. One of the challenges is that you need to kind of brand and market, you know, do your marketing that it's applicable. So it's more challenging. It's a, you know, the good thing is that it's a broad market. It's very large in size. You know, the sky's the limit, but then you need to really focus on branding correctly in order to appeal to that type of mass market.
For each different segment, you have to brand yourself differently?
No, you need to make sure that your brand as a brand can be appealing to all various segments, but then you need to create content that is relevant for those types of different verticals market. And that's hard. That's not an easy thing to do, right? I mean, this is something that, you know, we are still working. It's kind of a work in progress.
Can you give me an example of how you do it now, how you create content that appeals to two different groups of people without alienating either one?
Yeah, so you know, today we create content for financial institutions and, you know, we focus on the value-driven ad for financial institutions. We create content for retailers, right? And we create content for media. So it doesn't really contradict with one another, but you do need to speak to them in their own language. I think the interesting thing today is that when you look at all those types of enterprises and you look at all those startups and SMEs, yeah, they're all going through digital transformation, meaning the form factor by which they interact with their customers and users is digital, right? And that's what, you know, Applause is all about. And that's why we're relevant in helping them grow, right?
Okay, so when you started, even though Roy had an understanding of this business, you said, I need to validate this. We need to make sure that we're really creating something that's useful. Was it you who went out and talked to the VPs of engineering at different companies to see, do they really have this problem? Would they buy the solution?
Yeah, so when Roy kind of talked to me about the idea, and yeah, again, we need to remember that Roy is a really smart guy, probably smarter than me by a lot. Very innovative. And, you know, when he told me the idea, I basically, you know, I came from an engineering background. My focus was enterprise software. He came from a consumer software background. And I basically said, you know, I don't really know if that's such a good idea. So one of the things that I did do is kind of go to a few VP engineering friends that I had, which were more on the consumer side of the business. And I actually basically floated the idea by them and basically ask them a very simple question. You know, if we build this, you know, platform that facilitates interaction and this community that works for you, will you come? Are you willing to pay for that? And 10 out of 10, they said yes.
And why do you think they said yes? Was it that the price was it about the price? Was it about, what was it?
It wasn't about the price. It was no one was really 100% satisfied with the quality of product that they're putting out there. And I think they looked at it as a way of getting closer to the users and customers and getting real feedback that will help them become better, beat the competition, iterate faster from an innovative perspective while keeping tabs on what the market is like, right? Mm-hmm. And this is something that the time didn't exist, and they felt in their gut that, yeah, that could help me be better, that could help my company grow and beat any type of other competition that I have.
Okay, so they all said yes. Did you do anything to – did you offer – did you ask them to pay, or did you do anything to make sure that your validation was – that you were validating?
I actually asked them to – we created a side letter by which they would be part of a beta program. And they all signed it. And, you know, once we built the platform, it took us about 6 months to get to kind of an alpha level state by which we could open it up. And they all came and became beta customers. I mean
– I see. And the side letter said, look, if we build this, you agree to test it?
I agree to be a beta customer.
That's a customer. Yeah. I see. So they were agreeing to pay for it and to use it.
They were agreeing to pay for it, get it at a discount, be a beta customer. And then if everything goes well, become an ongoing customer. And, you know, the shocking thing is that they all converted, meaning after the beta period, which was about a month, they all became customers. You know, different size of customers, but they all became customers.
You know what? I'm actually writing, after doing these interviews for years, I'm finally writing a book. And the book is about this whole process of understanding a pain that a customer has and validating it to make sure that you're really on the right track. You did it. What did you learn about the product that you didn't know through this validation process?
Well, I learned, you know, so the concept and the idea was correct. I think what we helped refine during, you know, the evolution of the company is many things around the business model and then the interaction. We learned a lot about community building, community management, community incentives. We learned a lot about what drives, you know, what's the right price to pay on an ongoing basis.
To pay the tester.
To pay the tester.
I see. Uh-huh.
And also to charge the customer, right?
So and how did you know what to charge the customer? How did all this...
I just put a price out there and, you know, so if they were willing to pay for it. So, and they were. And, you know, I think ever since then, you know, in the first 3 years, we started playing with the business model. I'll give you an example. When we started, the concept was on-demand testing. Come to us. You know, pay $3,000 and I'll test your product for you. Mm-hmm. You know, one day I think I came to the office probably 2 years after we started and I said, you know what? Let's see how much we can push the business and make it more aggressively. Let's just tell them $3,000 a month, test as much as you can, okay, no limits. And that's how we moved to subscription, right?
I see.
And that was back, I think, 2011. And we basically saw that, you know, they loved the concept. They had no limitation on how much they can test at the time. Okay. They got a huge amount of value. And we actually transitioned our business to a subscription business in 24 hours.
And the developers that you put together, how did you find these developers and how did you get them to accept a piece of this business when venture capitalists who are paid to figure out who's got the right idea didn't believe enough?
Yeah, that was kind of, you know, kind of difficult at the beginning. So one of the things that we did is when we, you know, when we had this firm in Argentina, which did our first, you know, I would say iteration of development, we actually opened it up and, you know, thanks for social network and, you know, the capability to, you know, appeal to multiple people at the time via social network. We actually invited testers on various forums to basically come and test the first version of our software. Okay. So we actually used dog fooding, meaning testers that we invited to test our technology platform first.
To test this community you're building for testers who will then test other people's product.
Correct. Test our product, which facilitates community management and project management for customers. We invited testers.
So what did you learn by having these guys test it?
We actually learned that the idea that we had actually provided a lot of value because we were our first customer, right? We used it.
Did they identify any problems with the software that you didn't know before? What do you remember any of them? Was there anything that was kind of a head slap?
Yeah, no, I don't remember anything in specific. I remember we got a lot of feedback and we had to fix it. And we were actually shocked and amazed by how quickly and how insightful the feedback was. And I think just that just validated the idea is that, you know, user customer is king, right? It doesn't matter what you think internally, meaning what your product team says, what your testing team said, what your engineering said. The only thing that matters is what your customers and users are saying. Mm. And that's kind of at the core of what Applause is today. And, you know, I think we saw that on day one when we opened our platform.
So then how did you get these developers to work for you for equity?
So at the beginning, we actually started paying them.
I see. So
we had a very interesting model which is a little bit different today, where it's, you know, instead of, it's actually pay per value. So every time they execute a usability feedback or test something on a device or have a bug, everything gets rated and actually gets paid based on the values that they provide. Meaning if it's an exceptional value, they get paid at the highest rate.
Wait,
if
the developers did?
Yes, the developers and testers actually get paid at the higher rate. So
no, the developers who built out your software got paid based on the results and how solid the software was?
Correct.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And the testers from our communities that tested it got paid based on the feedback that they delivered to the developers. So we built a model that completely aligned incentives between the testers and the developers, and then eventually between the community and our customers.
Okay. All right. I want to find out more about how you got this community, how you grew sales, because so far we're just talking to your friends. I want to know how you moved beyond your friends to bigger and better, not bigger and better, but bigger companies. And God knows you've got huge companies working with you now. But first, I've got to tell everyone about my sponsor. It's called Active Campaign. Have you heard of these guys? Of Active Campaign, Doron?
I have not heard of them, no.
Boom, you're about to find out about them. Here's the thing. Everyone knows at this point that email marketing is really powerful. You ask someone who comes to your site for their email address so you can follow up with them and stay in touch with them, and over time educate them enough that maybe they become your customer and you build trust so they become your customer. The problem with email marketing is that it's stupid. I mean, literally, it's stupid. It's you get their email address and you send everyone the exact same thing. Over the past few years, we've all discovered something called marketing automation, which means that if somebody clicks on an article for your site, for example, Doron, I'm sure you guys do some marketing automation. If someone clicks on an article that's aimed at media companies, you want to start understanding that they care more about media company information than financial services information or the general content that you have. And based on what they click on, you start changing the messaging to them so that it's customized to them. That's marketing automation in very basic sense. You can do so much more. You can, based on what people have selected when they sign up, do some automation based on what they've asked for, based on whether they bought or not, based on how many times they've clicked. So if they click on every single thing, maybe it's time to set them up with a call with one of your salespeople. That's marketing automation. It has been around for a few years, but it has been insanely difficult. We at MixerG had to pay $12,000 just to have a team come and help us with our marketing automation software because it's such a drag. That's when these guys at Active Campaign said, you know what? This is an opportunity for us. If it's really powerful and it's really tough, we're going to find a way to make it easy enough for companies to fully use all the features of marketing automation. And so that's what they've done. It works beautifully well. People at MixerG Audience have used it so much that they've come back and bought more ads from us. And I've got a special offer here for anyone who wants to try marketing automation for their business. Marketing automation that's so good you'll actually use it. You're going to get, with Active Campaign, a free month. Your second month's going to be free. You're going to get two free one-on-one sessions. You won't have to pay the $12,000 that we did to get real support. You're going to actually have a strategist, a consultant who knows marketing automation, help you set it up. Two free one-on-ones, private calls with them. And if you're already with some other software provider for your email, they will migrate you for free. All that's available on this special URL, activecampaign.com/MixerG. activecampaign.com/MixerG. Even if you don't sign up, I urge you to go check out all the features to understand how powerful marketing automation is today. activecampaign.com/MixerG. Doron, on the community side, how did you get all these people to come in and test?
Word of mouth, basically. We build social technology within our community, and just friends bring the friends. And
did you incentivize them to bring their friends?
No.
You just said, look, but they got paid for doing testing, and so they wanted to share with their friends how they were making some money. Am I right?
Correct. But by the way, making money is not the only thing, right? I mean, when you look at community incentives, you know, money is one of it, but also being the best tester on testing this, you know, new Google type of app that was just launched.
And you are doing leaderboards and things like that? Like,
yeah, we are doing today, like leaderboards. So a lot of credentials are not just monetized types of credentials, right? And that's how you kind of build community over time. I would also say that, you know, one of the things that we do is we allow people in different types of areas of the world or United States to actually test software for companies that don't have an office there. So, you know, if I want to test for Amazon and I live in Minneapolis, I can. If I want to test for Fox and I live in Seattle, I can, right? So this capability of working from home and actually testing on digital devices and being the best tester for a specific team is something that people love.
By the way, I'm smiling because as you're talking about it, I'm going into the Wayback Machine to see what the site looked like in 2007 to understand what you did. You know what I see when I go back to 2007 is, it's kind of interesting. Utest.com, that's the old name of the company, Utest. Utest.com is for sale. The natural traffic to this domain is great. Purchase now for $2,700 firm. So that's
how much I paid, by the way.
It's interesting because that's January 2007. I then moved over to July 2007 and it says the exact same thing. Purchase now for $4,800 firm. It looks like you still got the earlier price.
Yeah, I got the earlier price.
I see. What did you guys pay for applause.com?
We launched in 2008. We paid for applause just around six figures. I think it's a hell of a deal.
Yeah, it is. Why transition though? Utest is a good name.
Yeah, Utest is a good name. I think what happened, in 2014 is we actually figured out, and again, this is by listening to our customers, that the values that we provide to them is far more than just testing. We actually do help them perfect the digital experience to the customers and users. And we felt at a certain point in time two things. One, we're not elevating the importance of the community enough. And two, that the name Utest as a corporate name of the company doesn't do us justice enough, right? And that's where we basically said, you know what? We want to elevate the community. Let's have Utest be the community brand. And let's, find a better name for the corporate brand, which better mimics what we're doing around, digital experience for enterprises and startups and SMBs. And that's when we found the name Applause, which we loved, right?
So I've continued hunting, by the way, through the old Utest site. I am now on the tester community, and you say, here are the advantages of joining. Flexible hours, work whenever you want on any product you wish, earn significant income. Then there are pictures of flip-flops, work at your leisure, and then improve your testing skills. Why would someone want to improve their testing skills?
Let me give you an example. Let's say you're testing a brokerage application in New York City, and that's what you do in your day job. But you want to expand your testing capability because you want to test mobile applications, and you want to see how bots are connecting and how's the interface of human voice like Alexa. How do you test that? And you want to understand automation, and you want to become a better expert around usability testing. How can you do that? Utest gives you the capability to do that. So belonging to that social network, taking courses in Utest University, and by the way, it's all free. That's what makes you expand your horizons.
I didn't realize that testing was an expertise. I just thought testing means go try this product and come back and tell me if any part of it doesn't work. But you're saying it's an expertise. What makes someone an expert? What makes someone really good as a tester? You're smiling as I say this because you can see some naivete in the question, but what does make someone an expert? I had no idea.
So there's various aspects of testing. There's functional testing, right? Meaning testing for functionality. There is security and vulnerability testing. I'm a security hacker and I'm looking for things around security of specific applications. I'm a usability expert and I'm helping companies make the application, the website, the app, the device more usable, right? I'm a load tester, meaning I'm the type of person that helps put load on a system and kind of perfect the performance. So we as customers and users and consumers, we expect software to work like a light switch, right? You open it, it works. The problem is that software is more complicated than that and it still doesn't work like a light switch. And in order for it to work like a light switch, you actually need to make sure that you test all those various aspects and perfect them to what the user and the customer expects.
So how does an individual test the load of an app?
So load, there's open source tools that allow you to put simulation of load on a specific app. you monitor the application under load, and then you look for bottlenecks, meaning what are the things that makes the application go slow, and then you fix them. So it's a kind of an iterative process, and you do that all before you launch an application. But I think the point that I'm trying to make is that you need everything to work really well for the app to be successful. Now, having said that, you also need the business side to be successful as well, right? But, you know, today, you know, I'll give you an example. Take any financial institution. The difference between a Wells Fargo and a Bank of America is no longer the branch experience. It's a mobile experience, right? How frustrating is it, you know, if you take a snapshot of your check card, of your check, and it doesn't deposit, right? You need to go in the branch. No one loves that, right? So it's this type of digital experience that is so critical in today's world.
You know what? Even after researching you, I still didn't fully understand it until now. I always thought that user testing meant give it to as many users as possible and have them do what they would do with it naturally. And you're saying, no, that's not enough. It's way more intense than that and way more methodical than that. And I had no idea.
Yeah, because I'll tell you what the difference. When you give it to users, you actually get feedback. When you give it to, and that's very important, don't misunderstand me, because we do usability testing, we do feedback testing. But when you give it to tester, you're actually trying to also find the core issue of the problem so you can fix it. And testers have the capability to dig deeper to specific areas and float the things that, you know, and also find potential solutions on how you need to do in order to improve it moving forward.
I see. So like, for example, but before you and I started, our Skype connection was a little bit funky. A user might tell us, hey, it's a little bit funky. Maybe if they're a little more advanced, they'd say that it's slow, but they wouldn't tell us why. And they wouldn't know it's because of this issue that was fired off by having Chrome in the background.
For example.
And that's what you want. Okay. All right. I get it. All right. So now I see the business model. I see where you got your first customers. I'm wondering, was the next step then to go and try to raise money and actually get it? Or did you continue to grow your customer base through PR?
No, we actually went and raised money.
You had your product and you had 10 people who said, I'm signing a letter, I will be your tester, and I will pay for it. Then you took it and you raised money. And then where did you get your first investors?
So first investors were actually angel investors. So I basically moved around between people that invested in young entrepreneurs. And I found this, you know, nice guy in New York. His name was Joel. And you know, he said, yeah, why not?
It was just you making phone calls and networking and getting through to people.
Yeah, more or less. You know, I still remember my co-founder, you know, after we got the first term sheet, he basically said, you know, he said something very smart. That's Roy. He basically said, you know, that's a big milestone because now we're really entrepreneurs, right? We're really founders of a company because there's really significant essence behind it.
I'm looking at Crunchbase. Since then, you guys have raised a massive amount of money. You've raised, is it $115 million?
$115.8? Yeah, it's correct, yes.
From Goldman Sachs now, Credit Suisse most recently. Wow, you guys have really grown since then. All right, so now you have clients, you have testers, and you have funding. Is PR the next big thing?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the thing about the company, which we haven't done great up until now, is great awareness, right? I mean, people understand the pain around making sure that the digital experience that they put out there, you know, is great. They still, you know, a lot of people that I talk to are still don't know applause, right? And I think investing in PR and scaling our presence, you know, across the U.S., in the Valley, in New York, in Boston, where content and technology and digital assets are being developed is super critical for us.
Why? I'm guessing that's why you're doing this interview. But I'm wondering, why does that matter to you? You already have big clients. They don't need more PR to trust you guys, do they?
I don't think they need more PR, but you know how it is. I mean, companies are always focused on top-line growth. And, you know, our mission in life is to own digital experience worldwide. And if you want to be the company that owns digital experience worldwide, and, you know, I'm not talking about hundreds of million dollars in revenue. I'm talking about billion. I'm talking more than that. Because if you really own a market, people need to know about you. And I think, you know, this is not something that you can do just at once. This is something that you keep on working on all the time. And I think, you know, for us, the journey starts now.
I guess I always thought that you guys had more brand awareness than maybe you did, because I'm in the tech space. TechCrunch, I'm looking it up. Yeah, TechCrunch covered you guys pretty well over the years, right? The tech software community seems to have covered you guys well.
You know, TechCrunch actually appeals significantly to technology audience. You know, I'll tell you something. Today, it's not just a technology audience that we sell to. We sell to chief digital officer and chief innovation officer and VPs of digital, because a lot of the technologies that is built today that interacts with users and customers today is not just owned by the IT manager, right? It's owned by the chief marketing officer. And it's especially true to non-software companies. You know, I think that the crazy thing in the world that we live today is that technology, software powers everything.
Yeah.
Right? You know, from your smart home to your smart car to basically everything that you touch. And, you know, this is being purchased by CMOs and chief digital officers. And that's the kind of audience that buys from us today, right?
Yeah, the example that you gave with the banks is a great one. I don't pick banks based on insurance and on interest rate because, frankly, the interest rates aren't that different. I don't pick it based on services because the services are the same. It's not based on people because I don't want to see their people. It's based on how well the app works and how well the website works and how fast I can do what I want to do. All right, let's get into 2009. Suddenly you get a phone call from Google. Why does Google call you guys?
Good question. I think they kind of heard about us, probably TechCrunch, maybe, you know, maybe some kind of media. And, you know, Google is a very innovative company, and I think they like to try new things. And, yeah, they called. Actually, remember, I was in Argentina at the time sitting with the developers, so I did the conversation from them, you know, from Buenos Aires. And they basically said, you know, we love the idea, we love the concept, we want to try it out. And I said, sure, what did you have in mind? And they basically, I think they had a small site around books, Google Books, and they said, why don't you try and test that? Tell us what you think. You know, we need to cover it in multiple countries, etc. So we did, and I think the results were so phenomenal that, you know, we immediately started expanding the relationship with Google at the time.
And are they still an ongoing customer of yours?
Google is still an ongoing customer of ours, and, you know, it's one of our largest customers. We test for Google today 14 different product lines on an ongoing basis.
Wow. And your focus at first was just startups. You and Roy said, you know what, we can't cover all these different – Google's an enterprise customer at this point, but you can't get everybody. And why did you decide to focus on startups? I feel like startups don't have that much money.
It wasn't – so when you focus on startup, it's not about the money, right? It's about refining your solution, and it's about understanding your ecosystem. Mm-hmm. And what startups are doing today around technology and innovation – enterprises are going to do tomorrow, right? Startups are the ones that started with IoT and, you know, with mobile, with everything around it. And I think the great thing about Google, you know, and some of those other big customers, you know, take almost anybody, Facebook, Amazon, whatever, they almost behave like a startup, but at a much higher scale, right? So I think the evolution from startup to Google was relatively easy because it's all about making sure the development innovation is there and making sure that the quality is there. The next transition after that actually happened to non-software companies, which is a different type of transition.
All right, let's get into how you hired them and not how you found them. But first, I've got to tell everyone about a company called TopTal. Top is in top of the mountain. Tal is in talent. They're my sponsor. And Daron, the problem that these guys solve is that it is really hard to find great developers. I think you guys started back in Boston, am I right?
Yes.
Yeah. So now you're here in Silicon Valley, and it feels like Silicon Valley is this small little world, Silicon Valley, a little valley, everyone lives together. But the truth is, that's not how it works. Most people live in San Francisco because they want to experience the city. Maybe not most, but a lot of people do. And then they have to commute all the way down to Google, all the way down to Facebook, all the way down about an hour and a half to go to work at these great companies. And they're super smart people, which is why these great companies recruit them. but they don't want to be stuck in traffic for an hour and a half, and they don't want to live in the suburbs around Google and their Mountain View office. So a lot of great developers said, you know what? I want to work around the world, wherever I came from, the original country that I'm from, the original city that I grew up in, and forget this whole living in Silicon Valley and trying to have this lifestyle that we're supposed to enjoy. And so TopTal recognized that there are these brilliant people all over the world who are untapped, and they put together a network of these great developers who want to work where they want to work and live the lives that they enjoy. They said, you know what? We have this great developer. Now, anyone who wants to hire them, who doesn't need these developers sitting in their office, can come to TopTal. We will understand the company's problems, and then we'll match them with the perfect developer for them. We at Mixergy did it. The first developer they introduced us to was okay. We didn't end up going with them. The second developer was fan-freaking-tastic. We hired him and got started within a couple of days. That's the way, if you're listening to me and you want to work with TopTal, that's the way it'll work for you. First step, you're going to get on a call with them. Second step, they're going to find you a great developer that you can hire. Many people hire part-time, some do full-time, some do even full-on teams from TopTal. If you want to work with TopTal, you should know they're created by two Mixergy fans. And so they're offering Mixergy listeners something they're not giving anyone else, 80 hours of TopTal developer credit when you pay for your first 80 hours. And that's in addition to a no-risk trial period of up to 2 weeks. Even Google doesn't get a no-risk trial period of up to 2 weeks when they hire people. They commit. Here you get to see that you get the best of the best and see for yourself at your company. Go to the special URL to get that offer. It's toptal.com/Mixergy, toptal.com/Mixergy. Jordan, I'm kind of whipping through these ads now because I've gotten a lot of feedback from people saying I was going too slow. Someone said, Andrew, I had to hit the fast forward button 5 times on you. So now I'm whipping through the ads. I take that user feedback very seriously. You guys can't like take my podcast and play it for people all over the world and get feedback on where I'm going with this. No, I don't even know. I think I should just go to my audience, shouldn't I?
Yeah, I think we can. I think not only that, I think you can also pick and select various types of demographics and get feedback based on different demographics.
Really? So I can say, you know what? We're not appealing enough to women who are 20 to 25 years old. Mm-hmm. Can you get them to listen and then give us feedback on the podcast? You could do that?
I can do that.
How much would that cost?
Something else. I can actually do that in a very quick turnaround. So if you tell me, go now, I can probably have something started tomorrow.
What does that cost?
So doing a usability kind of survey like that, I'm assuming you're kind of having a usability expert that go through the main things that you want to feedback on, and then having a panel of about 100 people which are digital savvy in different type, with different demographics in different types of the world, is something like
$10,000. $10,000. Yes. And it's a one-time thing. That's not a subscription.
One-time thing, it's fully managed. All you get is a value, very concise, plus access to the raw data.
I see. And I'm guessing that what would happen is companies who might have this exact problem that I just mentioned. We're not appealing enough to this demographic. Can you have them check out our product and tell us why or tell us what they think? Is that right? Is that a common request?
It's a very common request. I mean, there's another common request. Why don't you compare it to this type of application and tell me where I'm better and when I'm not good? You know how it is when I'm a company and I'm developing this type of software and I think, you know, I'm better at that and I'm better at that and I'm better at that, but my competition is kind of kicking my ass. So what do I do? Why? Where am I? What am I missing here? This is my demographic. This is my target market. Can you help a specific panel evaluate me against my competition? Tell me where I'm better. Tell me when I'm not so good. The whole idea is listen to your market, listen to your users, listen to your customers. That's what makes you better.
All right. So I see how you got your first customers. How did you get the next batch of customers?
So one of the things which was pretty interesting is I actually hired a sales guy.
And your first hire after you and Roy was a sales guy.
Well, I had the development team, but okay. You know, beyond the development team, yes, it was a sales guy. So it's a sales guy that I knew from prior life. And, you know, the reason I hired a sales guy is not so much in order to sell. It's more, you know, give me feedback from my customers, right? Tell me what my customers are saying and what else do they need. And he actually started selling, you know, and it wasn't that hard because, you know, like me and you talked, pennies everywhere. I'm going to launch in a specific country. I want to make sure that I do it right, right? I'm launching a new website. I want to make sure that the usability works as intended, uh-huh. right? My ratings in the App Store just tanked with my brand new release. Oh my God, what happened? Can you help me figure it out?
You asked him to first go to existing clients and understand how you guys were doing with them. Mm-hmm. And then he went out and got new clients. How did he get the first new batch of clients? What did he do?
Just awareness, meaning we had a lot of very interesting content around crowdsourced testing, which was what we called it initially. So that was a brand new concept at the time.
I saw that phrase used a lot. This was basically when the term crowdsourcing was just starting to make sense to people.
Yeah, that's correct. So people
were content. Was he writing the content at the beginning?
No, it was basically me and Roy. And then, you know, we started hiring a marketing person and he started writing content. And then we started having inbound leads, right, based on the good content that we wrote around crowdsourcing. And crowdsourcing was a fascinating idea at the time. I mean, now everybody knows, you know, what is, you know, communities and crowdsourcing and, you know, liquid workforce. I mean, everybody uses Airbnb, you know, the digital economy. Everybody uses Uber, Lyft, whatever. At the time, it was a brand new concept, right? People were fascinated by it.
I remember Paige Craig, the angel investor who famously got turned down by Airbnb when he wanted to invest in them because they didn't know who he was. And he's also raised his profile really well for good reason. I told him that I was getting married and he said, you know what, Andrew, you should crowdsource your wedding. That's how excited he was about crowdsourcing. I said, Paige, I'm not going to crowdsource my wedding. This is like you telling me I should drink the fifth beer at your party. I think I need to back off because no, crowdsource it. Here's what it is. And I get it. There was a huge enthusiasm and you guys definitely leapt on it. Here's the other thing that you did really well. I mean, I'm just going back and trying to understand it. Tell me if I'm right. You guys used to uncover bugs in apps that you had no business looking for bugs in. Then you wrote reports about them. So you would do like TweetDeck has 77 bugs, 13% classified as showstoppers, 30% were technical, 50% were wrong, right? So now you're getting all these apps that people know about and you're uncovering problems with them.
Correct. We use, so, you know, early day, we're talking early days here and we want to create some awareness to crowdsourcing and the scale and the value that it could provide. We run bag bashes. So every quarter we'd use a subject, you know, quarter one, you know, it's search. Let's do Yahoo search versus Bing versus Google search. Quarter number two, let's take, you know, the big three biggest retailers in the world. Let's see how Target maps against Walmart, against Amazon, right? So we run that, I think, for about, you know, 4 or 5 quarters in a row. It got quite a lot of press. And, you know, one of the things that we did is that the issues that we found, we actually gave to the companies.
So I mean, TweetDeck would have gotten all their bugs even though they didn't pay for it.
Yep. Yep. It was all free.
And everyone else got to see it. You published the results publicly. And then I can see here, was Matt Johnson that VP of marketing?
Yeah, Matt Johnson was the VP of marketing. We published the high-level results, but the actual bugs, meaning the issues themselves, we did not publicly put them. We actually gave them to the company.
So one of the ways that you got new customers was publishing these kinds of posts. Then people would see it and say, I'd like to find out about my app. And then they contact you guys and start working with you. That's one of the...
That's correct.
Did you do any outbound work?
Very little outbound work at that time. Everything was primarily inbound and some PR awareness and kind of, you know, we were one of the leaders in crowdsourcing at the time as well.
What else? So these posts worked. Did you do anything else to bring in new customers? Did you go to events and speak? Did you do anything like that?
So I did go to events. Primarily at the beginning, it was testing events and speak. So we created more awareness. And, you know, I think one of the things that you also need to remember is that we had this UTest community, right? And those were testers that were actually working as part of UTest. You know, some of them were, you know, freelancers in the space. But a large part of them also had a day job, exactly like I'm an Uber driver today, but I may have a day job somewhere else. I think the critical point is that we actually build an ecosystem because those people which are part of our community, which tested software for our customers, also had a day job at some kind of company testing software. So they actually went to their boss, their VP engineering, their director of QA and told them, hey, we can scale our quality by using a model like U-Test at the time, or a model like Applause.
This ecosystem
of testers, community members, and then customers, you know, is something that drove a lot of our growth at the time.
Well, I'm seeing posts that you guys did. Whenever you'd get new clients, apparently you'd do a post about that too. U-Test adds 4 customers to its rapidly growing roster, and the 4 customers were SweetIM, On24, Synthesite, and RepairPal.
Yeah, those were early days.
Yeah, they were. Do you do anything? How do you know what else to expand beyond? You've talked about how the name U-Test had to be transitioned to the community name, and you created Applause as the company name. And you said it was based on knowing that you need to expand your offerings, and the name U-Test was not descriptive enough of all the new offerings. How do you talk to your customers to understand what else you should be creating, what else you should be doing for them?
So, you know, two things. We run basically an NPS survey with both of our stakeholders, by the way. So we run an NPS and customer satisfaction survey every quarter, where we get a bunch of feedback from our customers. And then we do the same with our community. Because once you have a community of 250,000 people or more, and they're engaged with you on an ongoing basis, you know, they have good ideas, and what you need to do is be able to captivate those ideas and decide which one you want to go for and which one you don't. So, again, it all goes about to listen to the various stakeholders, whether it is community members or customers, and kind of figure out, you know, where you want to go.
How do you know what to listen to and what not to do?
I don't. This is where kind of, I would say, CEO gut feel.
But there's no framework internally for figuring out what you should be doing and what you should pause on. I see.
And it's a leap of faith, right? You invested 6 years in building a brand like U-Test, which is actually going well, and yet you actually decide to rebrand the company and go to that, you know, bigger vision. You know, that's what you do, I think, as a CEO and entrepreneur. You always need to kind of try and look forward to the expansion and how you expand your company.
Was there a feature that people asked for that you created that you then realized, nah, we made a mistake by adding it? We shouldn't have listened?
There was.
What was it?
So I'll give you 2 examples of where we kind of missed. So when we launched for the first time, we actually didn't have PayPal as a payment mechanism for testers, meaning the way to pay them for bugs. We had other types of payment mechanism. We had to develop that feature within a day. You know why? Because they're all screaming, we need to get PayPal.
I see. Okay.
So that's kind of one example.
That's a good one. They're screaming, they need something, and you understand why they need it, and you go and create it.
Yeah.
Was there something that they were screaming for that you realized, hey, we shouldn't have listened? They actually meant something else?
No, that was really screaming because they wanted to get paid.
I'll tell you the example. Paul Buchheit, the creator of Gmail, told me once, people wanted a way when they see their list of emails to just like mouse over it and see the message. And so he said, why would I go and build that? Let me understand why they're asking for it. And by asking them why they ask for it, he realized, whenever they click one of the messages, it takes too long to load. So they want a faster way to see whether they should even click into the messages. And what he really should be working on is a faster way to load messages when people click on them. And that's what he built instead. It was that understanding what people wanted or why people ask for what they ask for instead of building what they ask for. Do you have any experience like that where someone asked for something and you shouldn't have built it?
Yeah, so one of let me give you a really good example. So one of the things that we built in the early days was, I think we got a lot of feedback is we want a self-serve experience, meaning all the way from putting your credit card, building my testing team, right, and running my test. And we actually built this whole product. I think it was called U-Test Express or something like that, probably in 2010. If you do searches, you'll find it. It was kind of interesting. You know why? Because the media loved it. Meaning it was the holy grail, right? I can put $500 on my credit card, run a test cycle, get immediate feedback. And within 24 hours, I'm good. You know what the problem was? The market wasn't ready for it. The market wanted to, meaning the market, meaning the customers, they wanted to talk to someone. They want to understand how to build their team. They wanted to make sure that they don't spend a whole bunch of time, you know, getting the feedback. They wanted the data to come back to them much more matured, right? So the product really failed. Even though it was a great product, customers didn't come. They went into the website, they put their credit card in, but then they called or they emailed.
Right? Interesting.
So the whole self-serve experience failed.
Even I'm seeing it actually. I see a bunch of articles about it. Here's one, $500 per test cycle. That's not much. And they still wanted to talk to a human being. I get that.
And, you know, I think some of it was timing, right? The market wasn't ready for it. I mean, the market wanted it, but when it came to crunch time, it wasn't ready for it.
How did you make the leap from being someone who hits $1 million in revenue to then becoming a $10 million company? What did you have to do organizationally to grow to allow the business to grow to that level?
You know, I think one of the things that I've learned, you know, in my old age as an entrepreneur is that the way you need to think about your business is that it's primarily a relay race, right? It's the same people that you started the business with and not the same people that you're going to, you know, have when you're $100 million in revenue. And I think one of the things that I always did is kind of focus on the people and the employees, because those are the people that actually bring a lot of the ideas and build the company. And, you know, the second thing is focus on the management team, right? Bring the right people for the right stage of the company, right? And I think that's kind of one of the things that I did right. And, you know, building the management team, focusing on the people, because it's the people that really build the value for the business.
So that means that at some point you have to say to someone, you took the baton as far as you can go. I need to pass it to someone else. And you really will have a sit down with someone and say, you're good, but you're not ready for the next stage. We have to let you go.
Remember my first sales guy. He made it to $1 million, but I needed someone else to take me to the 10.
I see. And as a first time entrepreneur.
That's kind of sad, right? Because yeah. He did thing right, but he's an evangelistic sales guy. He can sell something evangelistically. He can't build a team, hire people, build a process.
I see.
And you kind of need to, even though you love the guy, like he's great, he's not the right guy to go with you to the next $10 million, right?
Was being in the Army what helped you do that, having that background?
You know, I think being in the Army helps you kind of make tough decisions from time to time. And I think the Army helped mature me into making decisions, because the type of decisions that you make in the Army are much more, I would say, important than, you know, I need to replace my VP sales. You know, I think you take the type of decision much, much deeper, right? So I think the decision-making process, I think the Army helps that. And by the way, not every decision that you make is the right decision. You know, I think I once read an article that, you know, if 20% of the decisions are wrong and 80% are right, then you're good as a CEO entrepreneur. So I'm trying to live by the 80-20 rule.
Yeah, I think it was my friend Jason Calacanis who said, you could be wrong every time, but if you make one right decision, then you're golden. You really do make a whole lot of bad decisions, which is hard then to look at somebody in the face and say, look, it's not you. I remember specifically saying to someone, I wish you would have robbed us. Then it would have been easier for me to do this. It's not you at all. You didn't do anything wrong. It's just, this is where the company is right now. And we have to transition away. Right, let me ask you this to close it out.
Yeah.
When I looked you up, first of all, I saw that you are on the board of Runkeeper. I freaking love that app. I don't use it that much anymore because for some reason it logged me out of 2 weeks ago. I was on a long run with it. I think I hit 21 miles and it freaking logged me out. It lost the whole thing. It was so frustrating. So now for the last couple of weeks, I've just been a little upset at that app specifically. But I've been using it for years. I looked you up. You're a long distance runner. You're a guy who's run Boston, what is it, 9 times now?
Actually, I did it 10 times, yeah.
10 times Boston Marathon. You're running a company, a $100 million business. How do you have time to run and how do you justify it when you've got to have things that call you at work?
Yeah, you know, I think having the right work-life balance you know, and for me, work-life balance means family, work, business, and then, you know, making sure that I have some off time. And for me, off time is actually, you know, exercising, whether it is biking or triathlon or running.
But when someone needs you and you have to get your run in for the day, will you say, look, I know you need me. This is very important. I have to go run. And when you say that, I know when I say that to people, it feels like they think I don't take the business seriously enough.
No, I think when you build a company as a CEO and a leader, you kind of need to appreciate the work-life balance.
And you've got to just keep telling people, it's not that I love this company, I'm here every day or whatever, I'm here every day, but I need to go for a run.
Yeah, I'll call you in an hour. And, you know, when I come back after my hour run, I'm a better focused type of human being and I can go for the long run for the day around work. I think what people need to remember is that building a company is not a sprint. It's a marathon, right? And the only way to build, you know, to look at a marathon, you can't look at mile 26. You kind of need to take it a mile at a time. And that's how you kind of build a company. That's how you build a long-lasting business for the generation. So if you're in it for the long run, think about it like a marathon.
So then where are you going to be in 5 years with the business? Do you know?
It's going to be bigger than it is today. I can tell you. You know, there's various rumors, IPO, no IPO. You know, obviously we're reaching the right critical milestone from everything that we need to, meaning customers, revenue, everything associated with that. I think the market condition is good. So, you know, maybe we're going to be a public company. Maybe we are not. I think there's a good probability that we are 5 years from now. But I think what's really important for me is to be that dominant company in the digital experience economy. That's where I want to be. I want to be that type of company when someone says, I want to create this killer digital experience, and it doesn't matter what it is. It's, you know, smart home or smart car or mobile application or whatever form factors they have 5 years from now, artificial intelligence or whatever. I'm going to think, okay, I want to kill it. I'm going to use applause for it.
I see. I need a designer or a design team. I need engineers and I need applause.
Correct.
I see.
I need to make sure that the experience that I create is the best out there. And I'm going to use applause in order to make sure it is.
All right. What's your fastest marathon?
I ran when I was young, less than 3 hours.
Wow.
My fastest time in Boston is 3:02. Never went below 3 hours in Boston.
And Boston, for people who don't know, is the one that you actually have to qualify for by running super fast. I'm not anywhere near that. I love long distance running. I'm fairly slow. My fastest is over 4 hours. But I love it. All right. Thank you for being on here. The website for everyone is applause.com. What an easy domain. And the two sponsors for this interview are the company that will help you hire your next great developers. It's called TopTal. And the company that will do your marketing automation so easily that you'll actually get to use all the features. Go check out the features just to understand what marketing automation could be for your business at activecampaign.com/Mixergy. Throne, thank you so much.
Thank you, Andrew. I had a great time.
You bet, me too. Bye, everyone.